What separates you from being just a good, typical doctor and an extraordinary doctor, the one that we're all looking to be, will be the ability to communicate effectively.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. I have long anticipated the opportunity to interview today's guest for the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I seldom make a guarantee, but I will today. I guarantee, after listening to this interview, you will think differently about yourself. And by doing so, you will think and act differently to others. We're delighted to welcome neurosurgeon, investor, and author, Dr. Nimish Patel. Welcome, Nimish.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. And you're right. I think after this conversation, those who are listening will have a different perspective and something that's meaningful to them and worthwhile. So I appreciate the opportunity. Always great to see you and speak with you.
Well, let me review once again. Neurosurgeon, MD, investor, MBA, and author, soon to be celebrated laureate. So for our audience, we want to discuss your recent book, Extraordinary Doctor. And for our audience, don't think for a minute we're discussing advanced medical technology. Actually, something very, very important, much more important, how emotional intelligence drives success. So Nimish, why this book and why now?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, in the world that we live in today, Bob, and when we're speaking to either whether it's high performance physicians or as high performance leaders in other industries, at some point in time, the IQ skills get replaced by AI or they get replaced by something else. And what gives a competitive advantage to the individual to ascertain or to be able to progress? It's the EQ skills and it's the people skills. And what I will say, this book is geared towards young doctors and those who want to be in leadership, but it also focuses into other industry groups as well, is that how do you do that? I mean, no one taught me unless you had someone, a mentor or some apprenticeship that someone taught you how to behave in certain situations to your advantage. That's very difficult to learn. And so what I've done in this book, if I may, is I've taken nearly two decades of healthcare experience. I've lived in the healthcare world that long. And I've seen, gosh, I wish someone had told me that before. And I would have implemented early on. And so that's where the book comes from. It is a very tactical, very practical book. And you can apply very quickly for individuals who don't have a lot of time.
Well, I'm going to get into a lot of the details on the book because I've read it thoroughly. I've actually read it twice. You had me on page one. That's right. A lot of these books, you kind of wonder what it's all about. But on page one, boy, you got my attention. And I'll try to set up the situation, then hand this topic back to you. But for the benefit of our audience, this is a journey of medical education. You have 4 years of undergraduate, like most people. Then you get 4 years of medical school. And you have a step one and step two exams tucked in there. Then you have resident matching, then 5 years of surgical residency, maybe two more years of fellowship. You end up with about 15 years of competitive learning. So Nimish, start on page one of The Extraordinary Doctor with a phone call. Start there if you would.
I think page one, without giving it all away, first of all, thank you all. You and my mother are the only one who have read it twice. So appreciate that. page one, in all seriousness, page one is a very vulnerable piece that I have tucked away for many years. And I'm speaking to all my high achievers out there. There are things that we will never share with anyone because it's too painful to talk about. And it's a failure episode. And I'm at this point in time in my career, in my last year of medical school, and I have done the things that you need to do. I have checked the boxes with grades. I have done the rotations. I have spoken to the professors. And I interviewed well. So everyone set me up and I knew that I was confident that I would move into the next part of my career, which was to become a neurosurgical resident. And what happened was just the opposite. I got the phone call that morning, and I thought it was a joke, to be honest with you. And the fact that I couldn't believe it, and I sat down, I was completely destroyed everything that had I had ever built up. And so it was a soul searching moment. And looking back now, 20 plus years later, it was a defining moment in my career that if I had not done what I did, which is pick myself up and barely make it, then I would not be where I am today.
So what happened? What's this resonant matching all about, the benefit of our audience?
So as you eloquently placed, after medical school, you need an apprenticeship. And that's in medicine, that's residency training. And each specialty, each part branch of medicine has a certain amount of time for training. And for us, for neurosurgeons, it's 6 to 7 years plus. And that's where you learn how, and you eat, drink, and sleep training. For me, it was neurosurgery. And so in order to you'd be accepted to that, such a very competitive apprenticeship or residency, you have to do things to make yourself in that peer group. And I had done those things. And when I did not cross the bar, I did not come over that hurdle, and I slipped and fell and tripped and skinned my knees. Boy, that was a tough time that I had to pick up. And what I did from there, and I'll stop here for a second.
Yeah, say some of that for the book, because that got me hooked right away. I said, I can't stop here. I got to keep going. So we'll let them discover more of how you remedied that situation. Sound fair?
Sounds fair. And I think the point, probably what I'm inherently saying is all of us have been through this process. And so when you read this, I want you to put yourself in that position and know that you're not alone, that there are other people out there that are seemingly successful or still trying to become what they want, what they aspire to be, but they have tripped and fallen as well. And so I share that story with you to say, hey, we're in this together.
Well, I need to share this with you because hearing your story and how you overcame it, it made me reflect. I missed my match too, and not a residency match, but a job match that I really, really wanted. And back in 1975, centuries ago, when I was getting out of engineering school, jobs in engineering were hard to get. The people at Boeing were driving taxi cabs because they didn't have engineering jobs. And I applied for this job, and I knew that I would get it, and I didn't. And I called back in. This is when you sent a letter and you didn't have email. But I said, I missed out here. I need to really revisit this thing. And I went back to the company. They liked my moxie. They said, we'll give you another chance to interview. The people I interviewed were all sick that day, and I didn't feel like I got a fair treatment, so I hung in there. And just like you, it really helped change my whole path, but it shaped my attitude to advancing confidently. So, like you said, this is a story that everybody, in the vulnerability that you expressed, that is so bold to do. Most people don't do that, but that's a great leadership quality. So I'm really glad that you led with that. But you mentioned that after 15 years of brain surgery and dealing with real grim outcomes like glioblastoma, you say your emotions have shifted from being about science and sympathizing to offering understanding to your patients. And you say, this is the power to make an ordinary doctor extraordinary. So what do you mean by offering understanding to your patients? What does that mean, Nimesh?
You're right. I think anyone, when they start their profession, especially doctors, new doctors, and who hasn't met a doctor or been to a hospital? And when you see them initially, and I think the internal feeling is, for us, it's the challenge. It's the ability to diagnose and to be able to figure out the problem and take care of the problem. And that becomes the tempo and the mindset that we do for many years. But at some point, what happens to us, and unless we've been exposed to it, is you cannot change the outcome. There are situations where it's just not in your power. You can help improve it as best as possible, and you cannot change the science of what's happening to the patient or the family member. And in that case, what happens is we as physicians have a duty and a responsibility that is not so ever taught, as the idea of moving from sympathy to empathy. It is the idea of, let me put myself in your shoes or your family member's shoes just for a moment and be able to recognize what you are feeling. And that skill to be able to just to do that in one moment with that patient or family member in a dire situation where they even know the outcome is grim, it can make a monumental difference and how they think about themselves and how they will be able to face whatever challenges they have moving forward.
Well, I want to hear more about some of these topics that you've highlighted in The Extraordinary Doctor. Like you said, your theme is to discover the essential people skills that you didn't learn in medical school. So I'm a little bit puzzled. Is there something about doctors in general that puts them at a disadvantage to effectively verbally communicate and practice these essential people skills? Is there something about all this competitive education that puts a shunt against their ability to do this?
How many times have you heard someone say, God, I love my doctor. She's not the most personable, but they're the best. They're the best. How many times have you heard that? And I think
many. Too many times, actually.
And I think when you devote yourself to a skill set of becoming, of learning a whole new art of science and the vernacular and the challenges of taking care of people and the complexity of that, you devote yourself at the sacrifice of other skills. That is anyone who is high performance, whether you're playing basketball, whether you're a race car driver or a Navy SEAL or a physician. And I think it comes at the sacrifice of understanding how to connect with people because there's just not time to learn that. But Bob, here's the difference to our audience. The real world, once you are done training, once you're out in the real world to my young physicians and my physician leaders and my business leaders, you all know this, the rules are different. It is not just about your technical skills. And yes, you can be successful with your technical skills to a certain amount, certain point. But what separates the ordinary from, if I may, the extraordinary, is the ability to connect with people in ways to get the job done.
I think the theme here is communication, and we both agree it's a very important emotional intelligence skill. And in the book, you mentioned some really good prescriptive advice in the choice of words. And I'm going to pull up a couple of these and let you expand on them a little bit. Using the word but instead of the word and how that makes a difference in your communication.
But there's about five stories of situations that I was involved or I observed where the communication was, you did this, but, and when someone says, but, you're already placed in a defensive position of, well, I didn't do it good enough. And so what in those examples there is that I discuss, instead of using but, use the word and. And what and does, it softens the idea of whatever you want to get across that may have not been out there in the first place.
I know using the word but instead of and, like you said, and adds to the conversation instead of putting a stopper in the conversation. So if you say something like, if you're going to be a good swimmer, but you didn't use your stroke right, you want to be a good swimmer and use that stroke as well.
Exactly right. But puts a stop to the conversation and allows the conversation to keep going.
You had some other terms too that I thought, these words are really like magic wands almost. You use the terms like, I have found that. And that becomes a suggestion instead of a hard rule opinion. Expound on that a little bit if you would.
For those of you who are maybe mentees or a colleague of similar caliber that you have to work with them and they have a difference of an opinion, or you want to teach them something, sometimes it's very difficult to have them understand a technique that you may do. For example, in my case, I have some talented surgeons that I work with, and they know that they have been brought up and indoctrinated in the way they do things, and I have been brought up and indoctrinated, and I have undone a lot of good and bad things as well to improve on my training. And when I am teaching a new young doctor, that if I tell them exactly what to do, it puts them in a defensive position and they're not willing to listen. However, when it's a put in the place of, I have found that, it becomes more of a suggestion, as you mentioned. And it allows an inception into the back of their mind. Therefore, they may consider that idea down the road without offending their indoctrination.
That's amazing. The communication, the choice of words. Now, you had some words that you said you may not want to say, like, it's the right thing to do, Nimesh. It's the right thing to do.
I think that I chuckled when you said that because I've heard that forever and ever in our industry. I want to do though, so-and-so because it's the right thing to do. And when that's being said, it is not meant to be an offensive term for whoever's saying it. They just mean that they want to do right for the patient in that particular case. However, if you're the person that has made that suggestion, or if you are the individual who has come up with the idea and the other person said, well, I don't want to do this, it's because it's the right thing to do, it implies indirectly that your idea was either a bad idea or a poor idea, and that doesn't allow the conversation to move forward.
So you have a lot of examples in the book that kind of coach you along, but here's the big question I have for you. How do you go about making yourself aware of better word choices? How do you make that happen? It's great after you've been in a conversation, you say, man, I should have said and instead of but. I should have not said it's the right thing to do. But how do you make yourself aware of better word choices? What do you do to condition yourself for that, Nimesh?
I think that's a great thought. I think, first of all, you said the word already that you need to do is you need to be aware of what can you add into your vocabulary to get your point across. And if you are in a position where it's an authoritative, it's a downstream vertical mentoring, then it doesn't really matter because what you say is law. However, if you are in a leadership position where it requires experts of same caliber to come along, then you need to find vocabulary, discover vocabulary, and put them in your back pocket to get those other individuals to come along. And what I've done in the book is give you that. And it's one of those things that you have to, first of all, be aware, and then you need to put away two or three types of sentences or phrases to be able to use them and be mindful of it until it becomes part of your instinctual behavior. Just like doing a procedure, just like doing anything that you have become an expert thus far.
So it's a conditioning process you can learn.
That's right.
Okay. You refer to the amygdala being hijacked quite a bit, and our audience may not be aware of that. And being a neurosurgeon, you know about the brain. Why don't you, for the benefit of our audience, just briefly discuss how to anticipate and deal with the situation we call amygdala hijacking?
Yeah, that term obviously gets everyone's attention. What does that mean? So just some basic anatomy. The amygdala is the emotional hub of our brain. It's the fight or flight section of our brain. When you see something, you see the saber-toothed tiger, do you fight the tiger or do you run away? So that allows you to protect yourself. And then you have what's called the frontal brain, which is the CEO, the executive of our brain. And what happens is when you are in a situation where it could be conflict or a conflict resolution, your amygdala starts to become aware and becomes active. And what can happen is if it's not checked by the frontal lobe, the CEO of the brain, you can say or do things that you may end up regretting later. How many of us have been in a situation whether we've been hungry or whether we've been tired and our decision ability or be able to handle stress at that time becomes less? Well, that's because the forebrain, the frontal lobe, is actually very tired. The CEO, it doesn't have the checks and balances on the amygdala, and the amygdala gets hijacked and therefore becomes either fight or flight.
Well, you mentioned a lot of different tactics and things you can do. Box breathing is one. You'd be proud of me. As I'm reading the book, you demonstrate how to do box breathing. You give an example of that. And I did it. As I'm reading the book, I'm doing this box breathing and I'm going, wow, this does settle me down a little bit. I know that in raising my children, anytime there's a situation where they're all excited and anxious, I tell them to stop and take a breath. Now I understand box breathing. You've done a great job of so many different categories of personal development in the book. I'm going to tell people that great stories, how not to get sued, ways to remind you how badly you might have been in the past, how to build trust. You talk about social engagement and teaching and mentoring and investing in relationships, all that stuff. It makes me reflect personally on my past encounters and behavior. And I'm not a physician. So I'm saying this book helps many people, not just young doctors and old doctors. I think it really helps a lot of different folks. So I want to shift the topic a little bit, Nimesh, to include emotional intelligence and how it relates to artificial intelligence. And you mentioned in the book, as a doctor, there's risk because one can become so fascinated with science that we ignore the human aspect and that you're treating patients and their families. And it makes me stop and think historically. Remember when the internet first evolved and created Dr. Google? mm-hmm. and how you had to educate patients on what it is and what it's not. And it looks like Dr. Google has earned a fellowship now and is now Dr. AI. So how do you address this next evolution of education with respect to technology with the thought of emotional intelligence?
Yeah, I think emotional intelligence has allowed the population, our audiences, to become more aware. And I think one of the things that we need to be aware of is, in the case of a young physician or even a physician who is in leadership, is the patients will come with their knowledge base of what they have learned from Dr. Google or other AI applications. And our job is, as physicians, is we are the authority. Don't ever forget that. But that doesn't mean you have to be authoritative. What that means is to acknowledge that the hard work and the research that they've done and commend them on that. And I talk about in the book exactly how to do that and make that connection with them. But in the end, our job is to guide them on what our opinion is and have them come an empowered patient. An educated patient is an empowered patient, which allows a lot of anxiety for both the family members as well as the patient to subside.
So where do you see AI finding its place in helping the type of problems that you deal with as a neurosurgeon? Do you see touch points there?
Yeah, I think it goes back to my very first thought is AI is a fantastic tool when used in the right way. Just like a weapon of some sort, it can be used for good and for bad. And for good, it allows to collect data, disseminate data, and quickly educate general population as well as us in the physician world of exactly what's going on. However, as I mentioned, at some point in time, everyone will be able to collect their own data and be able to interpret data because AI will tell us that. As physicians coming up and those that are in the world right now practicing, it is our job to be able to connect that information to the patient's anxiety and how they are able to take that information and be able to synthesize it and what it means to them. And that is an art form that is not discussed yet. But what I want to drive home the point is when all things are equal, when intelligence is equal, again, and AI will level the playing field, what separates you from being just a good, typical doctor and an extraordinary doctor, the one that we're all looking to be, will be the ability to communicate effectively.
In the newer doctors, the next generation of doctors, do you think they're getting exposure at all to AI? Is that going to be part of their medical education? Do you see that as something that's maturing, or is it still cautiously being addressed, or maybe skepticism on it? What do you think the perception is there for the new doctors?
No, from my opinion, I think AI is a tool that's being used very quickly, and it's used in medical records. The big companies are using it. I think it's used to how to disseminate data, as I mentioned before. So I think it's already in there. It is, what do you do with this information, and do you believe it? Is what happens next. And the truth be told, AI will never replace the liability a physician carries. And that is where our role is to become the truth teller. First of all, you have to know the truth. And then you got to be able to communicate the truth in an effective manner. That is what we'll see more often. And the ability just to look at data and you're the only one that can interpret it, will be long gone.
Good. Back to the book as a wrap up. I found myself growing through the self-reflection. It really helped me better understand who I am and who I can become. And I know the extraordinary doctor emphasizes the importance of being authentic. You show that right away in the book, being vulnerable right there on page one, accepting other people's ideas, being present, not ignoring people, looking at them in the eye and understanding them. All those things really contribute to being useful. And I think those are essential for anyone striving to be extraordinary. So my opinion on this book, it's a guidebook for professionals across all the fields. It's not just for those that wear the long white coats. So to me, it's an outstanding product. I'm so glad that we could talk to you about it. So any final words from you, Nimesh?
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Bob. And you're right. At the end of the day, I am a neurosurgeon, and what I do for a living and my fellow colleagues, it's a pretty high stakes game. And there's a lot of pressures that a lot of us in different disciplines that we have to deal with is pretty high stakes. So the book is a performance book. It is not, I want to be very clear that it is not just about a feel-good book and how to make other people feel better and we should do the nice things and things like that. It is written for you to become a better version of yourself. whether you're in the medical field or whether you're in other high performance field, my goal is to make you better and to reach your full potential. And that's the way the book is written. And I think you will all enjoy it, whether you're in medicine or not. Definitely with those of us who are in medicine, I think it will make an impact. And my goal, Bob, to, at the end of this is, I want to get it to medical school curriculum. I want to get it there to suggest reading, because I believe from what when I interview medical students, is there is some version of something like this, but it's not really taught in a way that's very practical. And if someone had told me these things when I was younger, boy, wouldn't I have become a better version of myself. And I'm still a work in progress. And so the book is not just what I wish they had told me in medical school, but the doctor I aspire to become and be remembered as.
My suggestion and how I plan to use it, I would like to give that book out to a book group of physicians and have them read the book and then pull them together for a 2-hour discussion. That would make a great case study discussion just to talk about what was in the book, because there's so many different points in there that stimulate ideas, and it'll carry a conversation for hours. If you're trying to do a short course, a short continuing medical education series on emotional intelligence, read this book and let's talk about it. So I think it'll make a big difference in people. So thank you, Nimish. A great discussion with Dr. Nimish Patel, author of Extraordinary Doctor, How Emotional Intelligence Drives a Physician's Success. Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.